Hello, and welcome to the Will to Power Hour, your friendly neighborhood philosophy podcast. Broadcasting to you in all possible worlds, I am Yosef Schiff.
I'm Alex Alt.
And Jimmy is not joining us today. He will be back, however, for the next podcast. Here at the Will to Power Hour, we spend the first few minutes of each episode reviewing a different craft beer. We then spend the remainder drinking said beer whilst we wax philosophical. Each episode revolves around a particular question or text, and today's topic is modal realism. It's a theory about possible worlds developed by the late philosopher David Lewis and laid out in his rather controversial book On the Plurality of Worlds. According to modal realism, and Alex will explain more about what it is, possible worlds are not simply ways of talking about modality or counterfactual statements. They're actually they're real physically existing worlds just like our own. And we'll get into this in just a little bit, but before we begin, as always, got to talk about our beer. Alex, what are we drinking today?
We are having Trogues Independent Brewing, their Troganator Double Bock beer.
Troganator. It's a wonderful name.
It is, isn't it? I love it.
Yeah, I looked up a little bit about Trogues Brewing Company, or Trogues Independent Brewing. It was started by two brothers named Chris and John Trogner. Established in 1996 in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. However, it moved to Hershey, Pennsylvania a few years ago in 2011. And the name Trogues is a combination, I thought it was kind of interesting, it's a combination of the founder's last name, Trogner, and the word Krog, which is the Flemish word for pub. I'm assuming they have Flemish heritage, or it could just be completely random, who knows. So it's got a pretty good rating on Beer Advocate.
And the label's got this really cool horned, I guess some sort of monster or demon or
Well, it's the Troganator.
Yeah, I guess it's the Troganator.
I would assume.
Don't
they have that on their other beers, though? Do they?
I don't think so. I didn't see it on the other bottles that I had. So, no, I think it's just this one. He is the Troganator.
The Troganator.
Are those horns made of, they look like they're made of either hair, no, they might actually be horn horns.
I think they're supposed to be horn horns, yeah, regular horns. Yeah, so the beer, it's a Doppelbock style, which it's a type of lager. It's a kind of heavy, a Bock is like a heavier, sweeter lager. They're very malty, they're not overly hoppy. They're kind of a meal in themselves, and a Doppelbock, I think, is really just saying, you know, a double Bock. So it's even more Bock-like than a regular Bock. So they're pretty heavy. And this comes in at a whopping 8.2% ABV, so it'll get you drunk.
Yeah.
But I guess let's go ahead and open them.
All right.
Pour it in my glass here. It's got a nice, dark, reddish color. Anything you want to note about the appearance of it?
Mine's still in the bottle. I don't have it. So I can't really say much other than it's in the bottle and it looks, you know, like beer.
You call yourself a beer snob.
I do.
Shame. Yeah, it's like got this, it's a clear, kind of dark red color to it. It's got a nice little head to it. Some lacing on the side of the glass when I tilt it. Definitely got a heavy flavor there.
Mm. Oh yeah, it is nice.
How would you describe what is happening inside of your mouth?
Oh, it's like, let's see, how do I describe it? It's like, sweet as honey, but it tastes more like chocolate. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's definitely got some chocolate notes to it.
Ugh. It's like honey and chocolate had a baby. Ugh.
That's one freaky baby.
One delicious baby.
Yeah, you can definitely, at least I can kind of taste the alcohol, too. You can tell it's a strong beer.
Oh, yeah.
Tell that it's a very strong beer when you drink it. Not sure if I'm going to be able to drink six of those, but...
Yeah, I think I'm just going to have a couple, and
it's very good beer, though.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, and it's great for, you know, a lot of people, a lot of people don't like IPAs and the really hoppy beers, but they like a lot of flavor, and I think that this would be a really good beer for those people because it is so heavy, it is so flavorful, but it doesn't have that overly bitter taste to it.
Yeah, it's got lots of strength, but not lots of bitterness. So if you like strong beer, but you're not really into the, you know, IPA thing, because it's just, you know, a little too harsh, this is very smooth, and it's almost like a meal. Like you said, it tastes like a food, only it's got alcohol in it.
Yeah, yeah, lots of it, too. It's like two beers in one.
Oh, I know, it tastes so good. It's like chocolate and honey had a baby and then doused it in alcohol.
That's very, very odd. Yeah. Odd image.
Yeah, no, that sounded a bit creepier than
you know,
I thought it would.
Speaking of things coming together to have babies, I really think that it's our duty as a society to ensure that Michael Phelps and Katie Ledecky have a baby. Because that is the future of the human race when the world is overtaken by water because of climate change. The humans that will survive are the ones who can swim. And we need to protect ourselves as a society.
Oh, yeah. Well, you get to work on that.
Oh, I'm already working on it. All right. So I think, you know, before we talk about David Lewis and modal realism and all the fun philosophy stuff. You remember about a year ago, Marco Rubio, during a debate or what, but he was quoted as saying something along the lines of, we need more welders than philosophers. And he went on to suggest that welders either... There were a couple of ways you could take what he was saying. He was either saying that welders make more money than philosophers, or that welders make more money than philosophy majors. On either point, I'm pretty sure that was a little bit inaccurate. But it just made me realize that a lot of people seem to have an issue with the humanities in general. But in particular, philosophy. A lot of people think that philosophy degree is a very impractical degree, one that's really not going to net you a good financial life. And I guess I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking about that. I mean, you know, Alex and I both are philosophy majors. We both double majored in philosophy. I was a double in political science and philosophy. Alex was a double in physics and philosophy. And I think in particular, we both went to law school, and I think that really a philosophy degree was actually pretty invaluable to me, at least. I don't know about you, Alex, but to me it was really invaluable for law school for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, it's the same style of thinking. It's basically distilled critical thinking, and you're just breaking down complicated arguments into their component pieces and trying to figure out an answer to a complicated question that doesn't have a clear answer. So it's the same style of thinking. It also, you know, I was looking up some information on philosophy majors and how they compare to other majors went on standardized tests, like graduate school entrance exams. So like the GRE, the LSAT for law school, the GMAT, the one for business school, the GMAT. And what's interesting is that across the board, so all these tests, basically, you can break them down into three different areas. You can break them down into an analytical writing portion, verbal reasoning, and quantitative reasoning, you know, math and logic. And what's interesting is that of all the majors, you know, the hundreds of majors, philosophy ranks number one in analytical writing, verbal reasoning, and it ranks just behind all of the engineering and hard science degrees like chemistry for quantitative reasoning. So philosophy majors, pretty much no matter what graduate program they go into, they tend to do extremely well, and a lot of it really has to do with the philosophy coursework. It's basically distilled critical thinking. You know, and the I was also looking at some data for income for philosophy majors, and what was really interesting about that was, of all the humanities degrees, philosophy came out on top for income. But what was really interesting was that it actually outranked a lot of the business majors, health sciences, and several other majors, really, again, coming in just behind the engineering majors and the hard science majors for income potential, which I thought was also really interesting. There was a, there's a chart you can look up on payscale.com. They do a study going back many, many years, and they have an interactive chart where you can pick different majors and see see what the income potential is early, mid, and late career. So I think it's just, you know, contrary to what a lot of people think, I think philosophy is actually an extremely valuable degree. I don't know what your experience or what you would have to say on this topic, Alex.
Well, right now I'm working in a fucking warehouse, so don't ask me. Like, so, funny story. One of the people who works there also went to Ohio State, and he noticed my Ohio State t-shirt, and he's like, oh, so what's your major in? And I'm like, you know, physics, and, you know. He's like, why are you working in this shithole? Mm-hmm. I was like, why indeed, old buddy? Why indeed?
I mean, part of that has to do with, you know, you moved from Ohio to North Carolina. You don't know anybody there, so you're still trying to
It's a tough place to find a job, and it's only a temp thing, just to, like, take the bar, but still, yeah, it's just like, I was just like, yeah, why am I working here? And then I thought, you know, this place has great esprit de corps, you know, people around here love it.
I mean, would you, you know, if you have kids someday, would you recommend that they pursue a philosophy major, or if they wanted to, would you dissuade them from it, or would you encourage them?
I would encourage a philosophy double major with something else. Like, have one as a practical degree and then one as the philosophy, you know, major. That's what I did, and I think that's a very good plan. Honestly, I think that philosophy should also be taught in high school. Some sort of philosophy, like logic, even, should be part of the high school curriculum, because really there isn't anyone in the country who does not need some sort of critical thinking skills, because we all vote. We all participate in democracy. We need to be able to analyze these sort of arguments, and it's not being taught.
Yeah, I would completely agree. I mean, especially, you know, you mentioned that we all vote. I mean,
well, not everybody, but, you know, we all should vote.
Anyway. I mean, the idea is that we live in a democratic society, an understanding
democratic, anyway.
Well, yeah, for all intents and purposes, it's a democratic society, and, you know, in order to really function well in that kind of society, and to properly have, you know, to have influence over governmental affairs, you really need to have an understanding of what democracy is and what a good governance system is. And that's all philosophy. I mean, the people who were leading the, you know, every major political revolution, you know, the French Revolution, even here in America, the Civil Rights Movement, you know, a lot of these people were either strictly speaking philosophers, or were well-versed, or were very well-versed in philosophy and in the humanities, because the questions about the proper role of government in our lives, those are ultimately philosophical questions. And they're not really just easy questions to answer unless you've actually really studied a lot of this stuff in depth and really, really thought about it.
And what's really telling to me is that even extremely intelligent people can go very, very, very far from, you know, far off course, delving into philosophy when they haven't thought it through very carefully and sort of wrestled with these issues more than, you know, at a surface level. Like, so, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson's, you know, insistence on, well, we should have this rationalia, you know, and the idea that, you know, we should have scientists in charge of the government and everything will be evidence-based. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, yes, that's nice. That's a nice plan, except that most of the big debates in politics are not solved by figuring out, you know, by the evidence, because the evidence, it's more about how the evidence should be interpreted.
Well,
and you can't answer that with science. You have to engage in a philosophical struggle.
Well, a lot of them are value questions too.
Yeah.
I mean, we talk about income inequality. Income inequality is a big thing today. that's not a question that you're going to really answer by science. I mean, you might be able to answer something like, okay, well, how do we have the most equitable in the sense of everyone having roughly the same level of income, something like that. Right. I mean, you can talk about ways of decreasing or increasing inequality, but it still doesn't really get at any of the core questions about, okay, well, is it necessarily a bad thing? I mean, you know, is...
And what things should we value most? And that's something that you can't really do with science. I mean, obviously science has a lot to say and is useful in determining things, but, you know, there's lots of questions in politics that you just can't decisively, you know, conclusively determine without engaging in philosophy, which, you know, you're not going to be able to do if, you know, if all you're doing is looking at evidence. There's more to it.
Yeah.
Data doesn't determine everything there is.
Yeah.
And that's,
I mean,
that's why philosophy is so valuable, because even if you're just, you know, it's not like, oh, well, everyone's so dumb and they can't figure out this stuff, so they got to wrestle with it. It's even really smart people don't get it wrong when they don't study philosophy. So, you know, it's very important.
Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately going back to college, I think I would do something slightly different with my degree choices. I would keep philosophy as a major, but then I think maybe instead of political science, I may, you know,
welding?
I would have chosen welding. No, I would have chosen maybe some kind of a one of the business degrees, perhaps as a second major, and then maybe minored in something like computer coding. And, you know, maybe taking a few poli-sci courses on the side as well. And I think that probably would have been a better way to go, a more well-rounded education. I think that my education, at least my college education, wasn't particularly well-rounded because it was all really focusing on humanities and social sciences. I mean, I really rounded it out, I think, in law school. I took a lot of business law courses, and I think that helped really round it out. But, I mean, I would really, if when I have kids someday, if they want to get a philosophy degree, I would really encourage them to. I would encourage them to balance it with something else as well. But, I mean, I just wish more people, one, knew what it was, because people don't seem to really have an understanding of what philosophy is. Two, I wish more people would study it in a really rigorous way.
Trouble is that people who understand enough to know that they should be studying philosophy are primarily people who have already studied philosophy enough to know that they should be, you know, so it's a bit of a catch-22 here.
Yeah.
No, I'm with you. I think we should even teach it in high school.
Yeah, I would agree. I remember reading a study that looked at philosophy courses being taught in British elementary schools, I think. And the students, when they were taking the philosophy courses, their math scores increased significantly. Actually, I think everything did, like math, reading, and writing all increased fairly significantly just from learning philosophy. Because again, it's distilled critical thinking. It teaches you how to think. So I guess we can move on now to our talk about today's topic about modal realism and David Lewis. So just a quick background on David Lewis, kind of an interesting figure. His name is David Kellogg Lewis, and he has this really, Kellogg, yeah, like the cereal, which was named after the pediatrician Dr. Kellogg, who wanted to make sure that children didn't masturbate. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's how he came up with his idea for, you know, morning breakfast cereals, that they were this healthy thing that kids would eat. And if you were eating healthy, you wouldn't touch yourself.
Well, they were originally
the
very bland. They were bland. Like, bland foods were used for that purpose. And that was why his foods were originally very bland. They weren't as sugary as they are today.
They weren't as sexy?
No, not at all. Yeah, now they're all sugary and they're, you know, that's why everyone's masturbating like crazy. But no, back in the day, they were bland. Just stop that.
Frosted Flakes make me horny, so...
Thanks, Yossi. We needed to know that.
What were we talking about again? Oh, yes, philosophy. David Kellogg Lewis. He was born September 28th, 1941, and he died October 14th, 2001, at the age of 60 from complications arising from diabetes. I think he had an organ transplant or something, and He ended up passing away from, I'm not exactly sure what, but just some kind of complications arising from his diabetes. He was born in Oberlin, Ohio. He went to college at Oxford, I think, or at least spent some time at Oxford. He received his PhD from Harvard in 1967, where he studied under another very famous philosopher named Willard Van Orman Quine, who is really one of the giants in modern philosophy. And David Lewis learned, you know, from the best. I think he ultimately came to disagree with a lot of Quine's work. But, you know, both of these guys are really known as some of the greatest, two of the greatest 20th century analytic philosophers. David Lewis is really known for his controversial theory that we're going to talk about called modal realism, which he proffered and defended in a book called On the Plurality of Worlds that was published in 1986. It was just, you know, his theory in great detail. I think it covers, let's see, how many pages is this book? It's like 300 pages, maybe? Less than that. So it's about...
a couple hundred something.
Yeah, it's about 260-ish pages. But then they have an index and glossary that go on for quite a while. And, you know, this book was and remains extremely controversial. It inspired a lot of work. Some in support of him, but mostly really just trying to grapple with his ideas and explain why they're wrong. So I guess before talking about modal realism itself, just want to briefly talk about possible worlds and what we mean by possible worlds. We mentioned this a little bit in the last episode. When philosophers talk about possible worlds, they're talking about something different than what physicists talk about when they talk about multiple worlds or parallel universes. These aren't places you could go to. They're not places you can see with a telescope. Possible worlds are ways of making sense of what are called modal statements or counterfactual statements. Statements that aren't true about the world, but they statements about the way that the world could have been. So, you know, if Alex's childhood had gone differently, he would have been the next Jeffrey Dahmer. He would have been, you know, a serial killer eating human body parts and whatnot. And did you not like that?
The examples of what I could have been keep getting worse. Like, first it was porn star. I could live with that. Now you're casting me as a serial killer? Wow.
Yeah, I'm not, you're not a serial killer, just you're...
Oh, just my counterpart. Oh, I get it.
Possible world, you are a serial killer. It's entirely possible. I don't know, you might be one in this world. I don't know. I don't know what you're doing down there in rural North Carolina.
There's nobody here, dude. Who would I kill? Really?
I don't know. Cows?
Aren't we all serial killers in that sense? Really, though?
Yeah.
You've eaten steak before, haven't you?
I haven't made a mistake and killed someone.
No, you've eaten a steak, though.
Oh, eaten a steak. I thought you said made a mistake.
No, eaten a steak.
Yes, I have.
Serial killer!
But I didn't kill the cow.
You did by extension. Indirectly.
But anyway. Okay, so again, just real briefly, you know, possible world, it's a way of analyzing counterfactual statements. So the statement that Alex could have been, you know, a serial killer, it's not true that he's a serial killer, but there's some, it's certainly possible that he could have been. There's nothing illogical about saying that. Certain other facts would have had to be the case, you know, maybe, you know, his upbringing would have had to have been different, would have had to have met different people, different things would have had to have happened for him to become a serial killer. And all of those facts taken together comprise what we would call a possible world. And when, there's another notion that we got to talk about. When we talk about possible worlds, we're talking about, again, counterfactual statements, but a counterfactual statement, you know, I mentioned that I mentioned the term modal statement. When I say modal, I mean that there are different ways. So if I make a counterfactual statement, there are different ways that statement could be true or false. It could be possibly true, in which case it's true in some possible worlds, or it could be necessarily true, in which case it's true in all possible worlds. An example of something that's possibly true would be, you know, Alex being a serial killer. There's some possible world
in
which
he
is.
Can we go back to porn star? Can we please?
Fine.
Go back
we'll say porn star. Porn star.
Okay.
Fine. All right.
I'll live with that.
If it makes you uncomfortable. There are some possible worlds in which...
It makes me more comfortable thinking, you know, the porn star one.
There are some possible worlds in which Alex is a porn star. Some possible worlds, like the actual world, in which he's not.
That you know of.
That I know of. When we talk about something being necessarily true, a necessary truth would be, typically we think of it as something like logical truths, like 2 plus 2 equals 4. You can't think of a world in which 2 plus 2 is 5. That's not even possibly true. There is no possible world in which 2 plus 2 equals 5. It's not within the realm of possibility. And likewise, you know, if we say that there's something is not possible, it means there's no possible world in which it's true. And if something is necessarily not true, it means there's... did I get that backwards? Sorry, I'm actually feeling this alcohol a little bit.
I know, isn't it awesome? I ran out of beer. I have to go get another beer. Can we take like a 2-second break?
Okay, go.
Or like a minute break?
Okay, go.
I'll be right back.
Okay.
Okay, I'm back.
Okay, so just to briefly recap, possible world, it's a way of analyzing counterfactual statements, figuring out what types of things would need to be true for example, Alex to be a porn star. And when we say possibly true, we mean something is true in some possible worlds, but not others. And when we say it's necessarily true, we mean it's true in all possible worlds. Can't be otherwise. So I just wanted to get those two concepts out of the way because they play an integral part of Lewis's theory, which Alex is now going to explain. Alex, what is modal realism, and pray tell, why is it so great?
Let's see. I'm fighting through the alcohol here. All right, so... when you make a statement about someone in another world, or about, you know, what could have been, like, I could have been a porn star, there's some question as to what you mean by that statement. What makes that statement true? Why, you know, how do you make sense of that? And so, according to David Lewis, you know, using... wait, we're going to explain possible worlds. Didn't you do that? Did you do that yet?
I did. I just did that. Well, that's literally, you know, just what I was doing.
I felt like it didn't really. All right, whatever. Anyway.
All right. So what? I mean, how would you supplement? How would you supplement my explanation of what a possible world is?
Okay. No. You're right. It was pretty good. I just forgot. I was drinking. Okay. So, all right. So possible states of affairs. Possible worlds are used to explain what it means, what people are talking about when they make modal statements like, "This could have been done differently," or, you know, "If this had happened, this other thing would have happened as well." So, according to David Lewis, the possible worlds that we use to explain modal sentences, they're not just these theoretical constructs that, you know, sort of abstract things. They're physical, real worlds. They really exist. They're just... but you can't go there. You can never touch them. Can't reach them. You know, it's not like in Back to the Future where you can, you know, go back in time and you know, change things and, oh, we've changed something in another possible. No. All of those places in the timeline in Back to the Future, all in the same possible world. Alright? Or impossible world, if, you know, or not in a possible world, depending on whether you think time travel is possible. But we digress. Anyway. So modal statements are explained by possible worlds, and possible worlds, according to David Lewis, are real worlds. They physically exist. They're concrete things, just like our world. Just like the actual world. And actual is used as an indexical term to refer to the world that you're in. So if someone says, according to someone in this world, this is the actual world. According to someone in another possible world, they would say the actual world is their own world.
And just to clarify, like, this isn't like Rick and Morty, where you can travel to these worlds and do all these crazy things in them, right?
Yeah, no, you can't ever travel to them at all.
So there, I think the term he uses is causally and spatio-temporally isolated.
Yeah,
correct?
Spatio-temporally isolated. So isolated from us in space, you can't, you know, no matter how far you go, you will never reach them. And temporally isolated, so, you know, it's not like they used to be connected to us, but now they're not. They just never were. There's no, you know, there's no connection. You can't get there, you can't go there, you can't, you know. No matter how far you go, no matter how long you wait, you will never, ever reach a different possible world.
So if I'm someone out there on the internet listening to this podcast, I'm probably going to be asking myself, why the hell would I ever want to subscribe to a theory? Like, what is so great about this theory? What theoretical work does it do?
It explains modality. So it explains what we mean when we make modal statements, and it explains how modality works at a deep level, at a level that you can't get to any other way.
Okay, why?
Because any other theory of modality relies on someone already understanding modality in the first place.
Okay.
So modal realism can explain modality to someone who does not even know what modality is or how it works.
Well, but I think most people probably...
That's part of it.
I mean, you know, if you just explain to them what modality is, you just say, oh, it's counterfactual statements about the way things could have been. I mean, they would understand that. I guess what,
most,
you know...
Yeah.
What work is... I mean, this... You know, his explanation for what possible worlds are, you know, would strike most people as absurd, I would think. So there's got to be a pretty strong reason for accepting it. I'm looking for that reason.
So all of the other theories to explain what modality means have problems that modal realism doesn't. So it can explain modality in a way that you don't need to have modality first, so it gets you to a deeper level. Also, it explains how you can have modal statements, and it explains modal statements without these problems with, for instance, eternal recurrence, where, you know, you have indiscernible descriptions. Two things that are, you know, essentially, for all practical purposes, they look exactly the same, and, you know, their history is exactly the same, except they're not. They're not, you know, they're not the same thing. They're, you know, if you have a universe in which everything that has happened happens again, you know, you're going to have people that end up being exactly the same as people who came before, but they're not the same person. Not really. And modal realism can explain how that would work, whereas other forms of, you know, other explanations for modality mix that up a bit.
Okay. So ultimately I'm going to disagree with Lewis, but I'd like to take a shot at explaining, at least in my own words, what work his theory is actually doing.
Go for it.
So you said it in your words. I'd like to change it a little bit, or at least focus on...
You would do a better job of explaining that part.
So I think ultimately what's driving David Lewis to such an extreme position is this concept that we have of modality, of possibility, is ultimately a very problematic concept. Any attempt that people make to really describe what it means for something to be possible ultimately rely on the concept of possibility itself. So they end up being ultimately circular arguments. And he has found, well, to him, he thinks he has found a way to break that circle. And what he's ultimately doing is he's taking that concept of modality, what it means for something to be possible, and he's reducing it purely to a statement about the way things are. The concept of modality doesn't even exist anymore in his new scheme. The concept of what's possible. When I say that something's possible, what I really mean is, according to him, is that this is the way something is in some world, physically existing world out there. So that's the theoretical work that it's doing. It's taking a problematic concept and it's dissolving it. A really major concept.
At great theoretical cost, but yeah.
Well, yes, there's a cost to doing it. It's a very unintuitive theory, and it seems to be a very extreme position. But you're getting rid of a concept that people have struggled with, that philosophers have struggled with for a very long time. And I think that's the legwork that it's doing, and that's what he ultimately wants to do with his theory, is to get rid of that concept of modality by reducing modal statements to statements about the way things are. And I think there's another interesting aspect to his theory. You know, we talked a lot last time about Saul Kripke, and Saul Kripke has a very different way of viewing modality than David Lewis. David Lewis literally views possible worlds as these, to use Kripke's terminology, they're like foreign countries. You can't necessarily visit them, but you know, for all intents and purposes, they're a lot like foreign places. They're places that you don't live in. They're just out there. And when we make statements about individuals, the example Kripke uses is Richard Nixon. This stuff was written, you know, back in the 60s. Early 70s. I think it was like 70 or 71 was when he gave the lectures. He talked about maybe Richard Nixon wouldn't have won the election. And when we make that statement, when we say it's possible that Richard Nixon wouldn't have won the election, Kripke takes this very intuitive view and says, you know, what we're really saying is something about Nixon himself. We're saying that he might not have had the properties that we currently associate with him, one of those properties being president of the United States. But under Lewis's treatment, that analysis comes out very, very differently. When I make the statement that Richard Nixon might not have won the election, according to Lewis, what I really mean is that Richard Nixon's counterpart, so someone who is like him in, quote, all important respects, unquote, in some possible worlds, did not win the election. So there's no, what Kripke would call, there's no trans world identity. When I make statements, when I say that Alex could have been a porn star, I'm not actually talking about Alex. I'm talking about someone in some possible world who's similar to Alex. And that's one of the reasons that this view is so counterintuitive, is that it doesn't, and I'll talk more about this, it doesn't seem to capture the way that we really use language.
Wait, Saul Kripke published this in the 70s?
Naming a Necessity, yeah.
Has he published anything since then? At least both.
So, he published something actually just a couple of years ago called Reference in Existence, but that's actually just a compilation of lectures he gave like a couple decades ago.
Oh, okay, yeah, we're hard at work here.
Which is how Kripke tends to work. He doesn't like to publish things. He did publish, actually, well, back in the 80s, he published a book called Wittgenstein on Rules in Private Language, which is a really good, which we might talk about in a later episode, but I don't think he's really done a whole lot of work recently, in part because he's retired. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, would you take issue with my characterization of Lewis's argument?
No, I think it's pretty accurate. I think, yeah, no, that's right. That sounds right.
So, I mean, what about it to you is so powerful? I mean, I know that you are rather taken with his argument. I mean, is it the central idea that, hey, this is a way to get rid of a very problematic concept? Is that what does it for you, or is it something
else?
Partly that, I
think part of it is just the idea that these modal statements can be read in a way that attaches them to, like, a physical thing. You can just, like, instead of trying to sort of weirdly shoehorn them onto existing, you know, actual objects and try and, you know, like, sort of weirdly, you know, attach them to someone that they don't really apply to, we can literally just send them out to some other possible world in which they literally apply. And it's like, no, that guy right there, that one, that we can't touch or get to or anything, but no, that's the one. That's the one, or those are the many ones in which this statement applies to, and that is what we're talking about. It's just a way of making statements so literal and so physical and absolute, and it just feels right. And I know that sounds strange, but I mean, ultimately it comes down to, you know, the main arguments against modal realism come down to what you think is, you know, most intuitive and least intuitive, and what costs you're willing to give. And it just feels so good being able to, like, put these statements on some concrete object.
So you like it because it feels good.
Oh, it feels so good. Yeah, yeah, exact. Just like this beer.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about
is the Troganator of philosophy.
The Troganator of philosophy. It'll get you drunk. It's very heavy. It's a little counterintuitive, and it'll get you drunk.
And it's like chocolate and honey had a baby.
And it's like chocolate and honey had a baby. Yeah. Named David Kellogg Lewis. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned that talking about weighing, you know, explanatory benefits against intuition, and Lewis goes to he says it multiple times, actually. I think that he thinks he's not necessarily making the statement that his theory is true. Rather, he's saying it is, on balance, the best theory because it, in his mind, correctly weighs theoretical parsimony or simplicity, as well as explanatory power, against intuition. And he thinks it's the best balance. I'll have more to say on that. But
like, I thought for a while that he didn't actually want to believe in modal realism.
Who does? It's fucking crazy.
He doesn't want to. Like, he didn't want to, but he's like, I was kind of forced to because I couldn't find anything better, and, you know, I just couldn't find anything that worked better. And he's like, I don't like it either, but, you know, it's the only thing that really makes good sense to me. And, you know, I'm like, that's interesting. I like modal realism, but I kind of got a warped mind, so that might be part of it.
A little bit. I mean, you do write monster erotica books.
That's true. I do.
So, I guess, I mean, that's, you know, I think Alex described it pretty succinctly. I mean, that's modal realism. It's the idea that these worlds are physically real. And the reason that we might be inclined to believe this is that it reduces a heretofore very problematic concept, namely modality, to simply statements about the way things are. So it has a lot of theoretical power, but at the cost of intuition. And I think that's a good description of what it is. And then, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about some of the objections. There are two main objections, I think, to Lewis's theory. And then I'm going to talk about a possible replacement approach that Lewis addresses in his book, but he ultimately rejects it. I, however, think that it's probably a better analysis of modality. So the first objection is the parsimony objection. When we say parsimony, we just mean theoretical simplicity. So you've probably heard the term Occam's razor. It comes from this medieval philosopher, William of Occam, who talked about shaving away, you know, with a razor, shaving away, you know, these unnecessary descriptions or unnecessary entities. So if you have two theories that both describe the same phenomenon, the one that is simpler, the one that doesn't, you know, quote, unnecessarily multiply entities, that's probably going to be the correct theory, the simpler one. And as a methodological point, it's the theory that we're going to accept. And so Lewis thinks that his theory is ultimately, you know, the most parsimonious, the objection to Lewis's theory is that it's not parsimonious. And it's not parsimonious because we're positing the existence of an infinite number of possible worlds. We're vastly inflating our ontology. Our ontology is essentially our set of objects that exist. We're vastly inflating it. We have to include all these new objects into our ontology, and it has to be of infinite size. So that's the objection. Well, Lewis talks about that objection. He says, okay, you know, you're right that I'm inflating our ontology, at least in the sense of the number of things that we have to include in it. So he calls that quantitative parsimony. He says, you know, I'll give you that. My theory is quantitatively unparsimonious. But on the other hand, it's qualitatively parsimonious. When he says qualitative parsimony, he says that, that's the kind of parsimony that really matters. He doesn't really explain very well or at all what qualitative parsimony is. He just kind of says it. He says his theory is qualitatively parsimonious. What most people think he means is the number of kinds of things. So, like, physical versus abstract. Those are kinds, and those are presumably the only two kinds that he means when he says qualitative parsimony. So his theory at most includes two kinds, physical and abstract objects. He's ultimately agnostic on whether abstract objects exist. And when we say abstract objects, we mean things like, for example, numbers. You know, there's a question about what numbers are. Most people think that they're these abstract entities or ideas. At most, you have two kinds. And in that sense, his theory is very parsimonious. It's just as parsimonious as any other theory out there. You know, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I'm not even so sure that, you know, let's just accept his claim that his theory, or his claim that qualitative parsimony is somehow the only kind of parsimony that matters, which, again, he doesn't really establish. But let's just, you know, assume it is. I'm not even so sure it's qualitatively parsimonious. One of the things he talks about throughout his book is the possibility of alien properties. Alien properties are properties that don't exist in the actual world. They're not something we can imagine, and they don't exist by any combination of properties or of objects in the actual world. There's something that's truly, truly alien to us. It's something we could never even conceive. And he says that there are possible worlds out there that have all of these alien properties, these completely alien worlds. Well, if that's the case, you know, why couldn't some of them have alien kinds as well? It seems to be just as much of a possibility. Of course, we can't imagine an alien kind in the same way that we can't imagine an alien property. But I don't think that is really explicitly ruled out by his theory. And so, you know, in that case, his theory isn't even really qualitatively parsimonious.
Can I jump in?
Yeah.
Real quick. Okay, so here's my response. My response is, so you mentioned Occam's razor. So Occam's razor applies to two theories that explain the same phenomenon.
Correct.
But I think that in this case, if you're bringing up alien properties, at least against any of the ersatzisms that you're, you know, bringing up, the linguistic ersatzism.
Well, we'll talk about that later, but ersatzism is just briefly speaking a theory about possible worlds that's similar to modal realism, but not quite.
Okay, so, but I think his response would be, or a good response would be, that they can't explain alien properties at all. His explain it at the cost of parsimony, but in that case, they're explaining two different phenomena, so it wouldn't be appropriate to use Occam's razor to eliminate his.
Sir, what do you mean they're explaining two different phenomena?
Well, linguistic ersatzism would be explaining possible worlds without any alien properties. It would not allow any possible worlds that have alien properties, because it can't explain them. Whereas modal realism would allow that, and it would require many, many more worlds, and so require many more entities, but they would not be unnecessarily multiplied, because you need to multiply those entities in order to explain this new data.
But isn't the phenomenon we're talking about modality, not necessarily worlds? I mean, I think the phenomenon that the theory is explaining is simply the phenomenon of modality.
Well, so again,
they're explaining the same
linguistic
thing.
Linguistic ersatzism is taking modality as primitive, whereas modal realism is not. So it's not explaining the exact same thing.
Okay.
You know, they're explaining slightly different things. So modal realism explains more, but at a much greater cost. So, but it's not like they're explaining the exact same thing at different costs, which is why I think the parsimony thing is maybe he shouldn't have delved into that at all, because, you know, they're not explaining the same thing. You know,
Okay, so I think that okay, I'm not entirely on the same page with you. I'm not exactly sure what you're getting at, but I am going to mention the stuff about the explanatory power of Erzat's modal realism. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit, so maybe we can bring that up again.
Yes.
But ultimately, my claim is just that we can vastly inflate the number of kinds of things, and in that sense, his theory is not even qualitatively parsimonious.
I'm not sure it's possible to have kinds other than abstract and concrete. Any more than it's possible to have a world in which 2 plus 2 equals 5.
Well, why not?
Because
I mean, he talks about alien properties. Well, why not alien kinds?
Because properties and kinds aren't the exact same thing.
Right, but why couldn't he have... Well, we should probably actually just move on.
Yeah, we should move on. I'm not sure I even understand. Like, I understand what you're getting at. I just don't think that that's possible.
Okay. Well, in any event, moving on to the second objection that I have. Lewis talks about the so-called incredulous stare. It's not really an objection. It's literally just people staring at him incredulously, like, really? You're saying that there are these real physically existing worlds? They just kind of give him a blank stare. And he quipped that he could not refute an incredulous stare. Well, of course you can't, because it's not an argument. But I think there is an argument underlying it. And I think that the argument that underlies the incredulous stare is that his theory is so unintuitive. Remember, his theory is supposed to account for modality. It's a theory about how language works. But it doesn't seem to capture the way that we actually use language. You know, again, going back to this counterpart idea, when I say that Alex could have been a porn star or a serial killer, I'm talking about Alex himself. I'm saying that guy sitting over there could have been a porn star or a serial killer. I don't mean that there's some possible world, physically existing world out there, in which this guy who looks and acts and speaks a lot like Alex is really a porn star in that world. I'm talking about Alex. I'm not talking about someone else. I don't think it really reflects the way that we actually use language, and I think that's a huge cost. You know, again, Lewis says on multiple occasions that his theory on balance best weighs explanatory power and simplicity and elegance against intuition, and I'm not really sure that it does, and I think that there's another theory, which I'm going to talk about, that better balances it, and that is much more intuitive sounding. But that's the second objection, is just the incredulous theory, the idea that this is very counterintuitive, and it simply does not capture the way that we actually use language. And ultimately, the theoretical replacement for modal realism is called linguistic ersatz modal realism. So he talks about all these various ersatz or substitute modal realist programs that kind of try to do the same work as modal realism, but without the cost. One of those, perhaps the most promising one, is linguistic ersatz modal realism. And under linguistic ersatz modal realism, possible worlds aren't really things, not just physical, they're not even really abstract things. When we talk about possible worlds, we're talking about linguistic ersatz modal realism posits kind of surrogates, theoretical surrogates that act like possible worlds but aren't really possible worlds. So what does that mean? When we say possible world, what we really mean is a so-called maximal consistent set of sentences. When we say maximal consistent set of sentences, you can think about this, you can think about a possible world as a complete consistent novel. Okay? So when I talk about Alex being a porn star, you can kind of think, okay, let's write a novel, a complete description of a world in which Alex is a porn star. So he had this particular childhood, had this particular upbringing, his parents had particular upbringings. It's basically just a complete description of a set of affairs in which Alex became a porn star. And it's entirely consistent and complete. That's what we mean when we say maximal consistent set of sentences. And strictly speaking, a set of sentences like that in which Alex is a porn star, it's not... So the way these so-called ersatz worlds work is they work by representation, or rather misrepresentation. So a set of sentences in which Alex is a porn star is actually a misrepresentation of the actual world. It doesn't accurately reflect the way things really are, but it is logically consistent. So again, when we say possible worlds, we're not really talking about worlds, we're talking about sets of sentences. And I think that it's a little bit more intuitive because we're not talking about counterparts. So when I say Alex could have been a porn star, I'm really talking about Alex. The drawback to linguistic ersatz modal realism is that we can no longer take modality as primitive. We can no longer reduce it to something else. So
we have to take modality as primitive.
Or sorry, yes. Is that under this theory...
Linguistic ersatzism requires that you take modality as primitive.
Yes.
Because you can't explain
You can no longer reduce it to statements about the way things really are. And the reason you can't do that is, remember, I said maximal consistent set of sentences. A consistent set of sentences is a set of sentences which could all be true together. That word could, that is a modal notion. It's what?
Modal.
Yes, it's modal. It's a modal notion.
Sorry.
It's ultimately going to be circular. You might be able to explain away modality using another theory, but ultimately, working within the constraints of this theory, you're gonna have to just take it as a primitive because you cannot explain it away. But I think that it's a far more intuitive theory, and it makes a lot more sense, and it is a better account of the way that we actually use language than David Lewis's modal realism. And it's more parsimonious because we don't do anything to complicate our ontology. We're not introducing all of these new worlds into it. At most, we just require the existence of sets, which is it's a mathematical notion. A set, it's this abstract object that we're already more or less committed to. So it seems to be, depending on how you look at his theory, either just as parsimonious as it or more so. So I think that it's ultimately a better description of how modality works. What do you think, Alex?
So let's see. Where was I? All right, so I think that taking modality as primitive is a big cost, and I think people underestimate that cost, and I think that's part of why they reject modal realism, is because they don't... I think people dismiss how much that's a problem. I think, or at least they don't appreciate how cool it is to be able to lose the modality as a primitive concept. Because I think it's not as unintuitive to think of other, of modal sentences describing another world. Because, so for instance, you're watching a TV show, and one of the characters is explaining to the other, this is what would happen if you, made some horrible choice, And it sort of cuts away to another scene in which that same actor is portraying the character in a different scenario, and all these things play out, and then something horrible happens to him, right? Well, does it really make sense to describe what they're talking about as talking about that character, the original character?
Yes.
Well, it doesn't really, because he's never going to do those things.
But if you ask someone on the street what they meant when they said, this guy could have done this thing, and you ask them, are you really talking about that guy, or are you really talking about someone else who exists in a far-off world that you can never travel to? I guarantee you they're all going to say, oh, I'm talking about that guy.
Right, if you talk about it in theoretical terms, sure, they're not going to understand that, but again... Well,
but that's what we're talking about, right?
Well, but again, if it's all about... Like, if you phrase it that way, of course, but again...
What do you mean if I phrase... That's the question. Are you talking about that person, or are you talking about someone who's a lot like that person in an isolated world that you can never travel to?
I mean, if you couch it in philosophical terms they don't understand, of course they're not going to agree with that. But
they
again,
could understand that perfectly well.
Most people on the street don't even know what spatiotemporally isolated means. They would
No, but you could ask them, I mean, you can say, like, are you really talking about that person? And they would say yes. And that's
well, again,
how language works.
They're making a modal statement about that person, but again, are they really... Is the person that they're describing as doing all these horrible things the person that they're originally talking about? I think a lot of people would say, no, that doesn't make sense, because he would never, you know, he's not the kind of guy who would do that. I mean,
right,
he could have done
about,
that had he,
but
had
they're
he been
thinking
raised
about...
differently. Well, right, but you're again, you're saying, so if he had been raised differently, well, by the time you're done with that sentence, you're no longer talking about him. You're talking about somebody else.
They would say that I am talking about him. They would say, like, oh, yes, if he had been raised differently, he would have been a different kind of person.
He would have done certain
things. It's
still
him. It's still him. He just would be acting different.
Well, but I think a lot of people would say that the whole, if he had been raised differently, means it's not him anymore. Because he wasn't raised differently. He was raised the way he was. So we're now talking about somebody different. And so this other possible world makes perfect sense in that way.
I think that the world is on my side.
I think you overestimate the consensus, because I don't think that
I think
you know,
that
you're 99, giving it a fair chance.
I think that 99% of the world is on my side.
I think you're dead wrong, because you're again you're overestimating how much of a consensus there is, because you're explaining modal realism in the most precise and abstract theoretical terms, and explaining linguistic ersatzism in the most everyday terms possible. And so, of course, it sounds better.
I don't
better.
Think so. I mean, ultimately, I again, it's a question about, it's just a question about what I mean when I say you could have been a porn star or a serial killer. I think most people say, I am talking about you. I'm talking about you, that guy.
But are
sitting
you...
there in North Carolina, drinking beer and talking
yeah,
about
you're
Luffy,
making
like, you, that
statements
guy.
About me, about this guy, certainly. But that's true even with modal realism. You're
no,
making
it's
modal
not.
Statements about me.
No, it's
you're
not.
You're making a modal statement about me.
That's not true according to modal realism. I'm not making a statement about you. I really mean translate that statement is actually translated from there is a guy who is like you in all important respects in some possible
like
world.
Me in all important respect. Like me.
Like
you're
referring
to me.
But it's not
exactly.
You. But
right,
not
right. But
you.
But that sentence is referring to me in that you're referring.
No,
to
No, it's
me in
referring
that sentence.
To a guy like you.
But you have to include the word "you" in that sentence. You have
Why
to
can't
refer
you just
to
admit
me
that
in the
I'm
sentence.
Right? Why can't you just admit that I'm right?
Because listen, you're saying you can't refer. So construct a modal sentence about me without mentioning me. You can't do it. It doesn't make any sense.
Right,
when
but
you're making a claim
the subject
of, you know,
is the guy who is, it, for a modal realist, the subject isn't you, it's the guy who's like you.
Right,
it's
but you're
the,
still
the
talking
Alex
about
like
me.
Individual. Well,
you're
yeah,
talking
you're
about
included,
me indirectly, certainly.
You're included in under the ambit of the sentence, but the sentence isn't really about you under modal realism, it's about the other guy.
Right, but again, in ersatzism, the sentence isn't, you know, the actions aren't done by you. They're something that could have been done by you, but they're not actually done by you.
I
so
think we've
in
reached,
the same, so
I
it's
think
still
an
it's still not direct. So again, even with a modal statement about me under the analysis of modal realism, you still have to refer to me in that sentence. The real me, the me, not you know the abstract, you know, not some other me. You have to refer to me in order to make that sentence work.
I think we've reached an impasse, so...
Alright.
Next time, on the World of Power Hour, we're going to be talking about prison and justice and whatnot. We're going to be talking about Jeremy Bentham's idea of the Panopticon.
Yeah.
A wonderfully, according to him, wonderfully efficient prison in which a guard, well, I was going to say in which a guard can observe all prisoners at once, but they're not really observing all prisoners at once. It's just that the prisoners know they could be observed at any possible moment, and so they magically adopt this
very docile behavior.
So we're going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about a French philosopher, Michel Foucault. We're going to be talking about his response or his elaboration of the idea in his book on Discipline and Punish, I think it was called. It was called Discipline and Punish. So, yes, that's what it was called.
Discipline and...
No, no, because they're both verbs, I think.
Weird.
In other words,
to discipline and right. to punish.
Right.
That is what we're going to do to you. On our next Will to Power Hour, we are going to
discipline
and punish you.
And punish you. You like that, don't you?
Well,
and so Michel Foucault kind of takes this idea and he says, like, hey, from what I understand, he sees some problems with the idea in terms of what we want our justice, how we want our system of justice to be structured. And he kind of sees society falling into this authoritarian abyss. That is reminiscent of the Panopticon. So we will be talking about what the concept is, what Bentham intended the concept to be, and then what Michel Foucault, what his expansion of the concept was. God, I've only had two of these beers, and I'm pretty drunk.
Can we get back to modal realism for like 2 seconds?
Literally? Jesus Christ, fine.
No. Just for me to say that.
Okay, go on.
One of the big objections to the incredulous to modal realism is this: the idea that positing all these real worlds is just too fucking weird. People just can't accept it.
Yes.
Yeah. And I just wanted to say that maybe one of the reasons that I found modal realism so appealing and didn't really, you know, feel the downside so much is because after studying quantum mechanics, just nothing seems weird anymore.
Yeah, there's some weird shit that happens with entangled electrons.
Dude, subatomic particles are so fucking weird. Oh my god.
They really are. You know what else is weird? And
what?
Michael Phelps. I think he broke physics.
Nah, he's really good at swimming.
I think he broke physics.
I think there was this one person who said it best, you know, it's really cruel that we have Michael Phelps swimming around in a pool. We should let him back in the ocean with the other mermen.
I know, right? Yeah, he's kind of a freak of nature.
He's amazing. But yeah.
I just remember 2008 Olympics. It was the... God, I want to say it was like the 4x100 free relay or maybe the medley relay. I don't recall exactly. But like the French team was talking all this crap about the U.S. team and talk about how they were gonna beat the U.S. team. And we beat them by like a fraction of a second. And I remember this very clearly because I was in the common area of my college dorm at the time. And we were all just flipping out when the U.S. won because it was by a fraction of a second. And the French team just looked so defeated and deflated, and it was just, oh god, it was beautiful.
Fun times.
You mentioned Back to the Future. I was actually watching it last night. So, the funny thing was, Michael Phelps' last race in the Olympics was last night, Saturday night, at 10:04 p.m. And in Back to the Future, they explicitly said, because they were talking about how lightning hit like the clock tower, and that's how they were going to get enough energy in the absence of the plutonium that they needed. That's how they were going to get the energy to power the flux capacitor.
Uh-huh.
So they were saying that lightning will strike Saturday night at 10:04 p.m. That is the exact day and time that Michael Phelps was scheduled to swim his very last race.
Wait, he's retiring after this?
That was his last race.
Ever?
He's never. Yeah, ever? Yeah, his last race ever. It was the 4x100 medley relay. He was swimming butterfly. The U.S. won. Lightning struck at 10:04 p.m. Saturday night. That was the scheduled time.
Nice.
I think it was delayed by a couple of minutes, so I don't think they swam until a couple of minutes later. But it was scheduled for 10:04 p.m. and we're watching it like 2 hours before it was going to happen. I'm like, wait a minute, did they just say that Lightning was going to strike Saturday night at 10:04 p.m. because that's when Michael Phelps is swimming his last fucking race?
That's awesome.
I know. But yeah. This was a rather short Will to Power Hour.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we didn't really get into the, you know, craziness of last time.
I didn't feel quite as prepared for this one.
Neither did I, but that's okay, because I think we did just fine. We did a nice, short, sweet, you know, just like this beer. It was sweet. It was this podcast. This particular episode of the podcast was like chocolate and honey had a baby.
That's exactly. It was like chocolate and honey had a baby. You got real drunk real fast with that 8.2% ABV. It was strong. It was quick. It's how you like it.
Always, in every possible world.
Ugh.